And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Up next, the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, to-ing and fro-ing back in Washington, D.C. on your behalf, just having been at the Commonweal Gathering in Bolinas, which was splendiferous. We go, huh, so we are pattern-tracking beings. It organizes our mind when we perceive patterns, just what wants to be reflected. And we say all moments in time await our dedication to animate the desirable opportunities being proffered to us. So it is November 13th, and in the sky mythic pattern, we have Mars at 13 Capricorn, the Moon at 13 Leo, Chiron at 13 Pisces, and we go 13, 13, 13. We love 13. So we will honor that. We know that squares, conflict, 90-degree angles in our lives are where we're assigned the task of getting illusorily estranged principles to dance together in us and in the world. So gliding into exactitude right now is the Sun in Scorpio, again, the backstage realm of the invisible, squaring Jupiter, storytelling god in Leo, whose image is creativity, seeking manifestation, birth of a new spiritual vitality, angelic lyricism, healing human fragmentation. And we go, sure, let's go for that. So our theme really this week is pragmatic mysticism, meaning how do we apply all teachings so that they make the world better for all critters, all flora, all fauna, applied divination, and my own term, democratic animism, meaning a willingness to cooperate with everything. So more than perfectly, I welcome splendiferously erudite lupine, chief strategist and arts innovation program director at Commonweal, Oren Slosberg, that the purpose of ritual magic is to spiral into group mind, expanded wisdom and tolerance. So let's do that. If all war is a failure of imagination, then all peace is a triumph of imagination. Welcome, Oren.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
That's great. It's good. So I love our conversations. We met last summer and cahooted often backstage, and then you were just presiding over the Commonweal Gathering. And I did take a peek at your astrological chart. I just want to bring a little bit of the you part of all of us into play, because it's so pertinent and beautiful. You know, when you were born, the Moon in eighth house of ancestral download, and its image is the Council of Ancestors, a young leader listens to their voices, and we go, yes, let's do that. It's got a quirky angle to your creative, feisty, Uranus trickster self, whose image is a guardian angel watches over a couple in the wilderness. So let's invite that in. And then your Moon quintiles Jupiter, irresistible eloquence and bringing traditional knowledge into fresh vernacular expression that can appeal to all young heroes and heroines. So there you have it for now.
That's perfect.
It is perfect. One last thing before we get to go free range and cavort and dance with each other. You are right now having your Chiron return. Chiron is a little planetoid that really does exist, and people go, oh, the wounded healer, and we go, that's the boring part. Chiron is the first Western mythological figure to be a mentor. He's a centaur. So he's a centaur mentor, and he starts a school for future cultural heroes, and so are you, kind of, right?
I don't know about hero, but I definitely feel like I'm in constant schooling.
Right. No, no, but you are mentor. You are mentor. There's leadership programs. We had young and medium and old people at the gathering. And I did, when somebody said, oh, we turn it over to the younger generation, I go, that's very colonial. No ghettos. We want everybody dancing with everybody.
And you want to turn it over with the younger generation, I think.
With. That's right. No, because, yeah, and then our adorable leader who was saying, you all are very special. And I go, special? Maybe not. That's a celebrity word. How about unique? And he was like, yes, unique. Because we both, you and I, and probably everybody listening, love language. So I like... Pluto's providing a giant composting cauldron, so I like throwing special into the cauldron and ladling out unique, because special is, it's a kind of colonial, you know, celebrity thing, like, ooh, ooh. Everyone who is unique encourages everybody else to become unique, and that is one of your medicine gifts, I think, that you encourage the uniqueness in all beings.
I hope so. I mean, the part, I think, of being a mentor is actually being a partner as much as being a mentor. And it's kind of a new position. Just as I turned around 50 last year, I suddenly find myself often in the company of people that I used to think that I was of the same age. And suddenly at the gathering, there was a collection of people from a whole spectrum of ages. And I felt that there was a strong sense of mentorship, both from some different parts of the age chronology, younger and older and at the same age. It seems that that's been kind of a theme that's been accompanying me for the last few years.
Well, I think extending the invitation, you know, to all of our dynamic listeners and everyone in the memosphere, we need the awakened imagination of everyone. Right-wing golfers, inner-city kids, I mean, everybody, you know, Ollie, income-free. So, and then this dance of Venus and Mars, and just for the fun of it, we'd say Venus suggests that the word dance to replace struggle and fight, it's going to be a long, hard dance. You know, we must engage in the creative dance. So are you up for replacing fight and struggle with dance?
Yes, definitely. And I think that we have proven that again and again. Fighting, just people fight back. And after growing up in the Middle East for so many years, I think dancing would have been a better direction to move than fighting. I understand the complexity, the depth of the feelings around it, but we've tried fighting for 3,000 years. I don't know.
Yes. Well, let's go exactly there, you know, to the quote I often use from John Michael Greer. If you want people to get nothing done but conflict, convince them they're on one side of something, especially if you have a wall. If what two needs is three, which is the spiraling in of the unifying story, the irresistibly eloquent unifying story going, and it can be the irresistibly eloquent, unifying, against all odds story. Maybe also we can sort of spiritual archaeology growing up in the Middle East. I like to say where there's, you know, hyper yang, too much Mars, then let's go for the Venus, the kind of esoteric hidden Venus, the Shekinah, the exiled thing that now is eager to be invited. So might you want to bring in the Venusian aspects of the Kabbalah or not? You know, again, free range.
The idea of inviting the Shekhinah, which is sometimes seen as the feminine divinity in Judaism, I think would be a welcome guest. And I don't think you see that in some of the parts of the Jewish population that are in the land of Israel right now. And maybe having some of that feminine energy might open a new vessel. Maybe more dancing might come through. I don't know. After being there, I did leave 25 years ago. But, it seems always that things cannot get worse, but it seems that kind of yin energy keeps pushing us ahead. And in inviting the Shekhinah would be a whole new different kind of dialogue. It would be a whole different kind of language.
Well, it is one of the best theatrical pieces I ever saw. It was 1981 in San Francisco. It was the Traveling Jewish Theater, and they had a play called The Return of the Shekhinah, and it was so fabulous. And we go, all right, let's keep that going. The return of what has been exiled, because it is its exile that has led us into this, So I wanted to, my kind hostess, hello, Kathy, loaned me this book, The Essential Kabbalah. Andy Weil and I started studying the Kabbalah in 1970 as powerful visualizing wisdom. It's great because apparently nobody's ever read more than page 1 and 2 of this book. But it is, I did love that the Hebrew word Kabbalah means receiving, and as one of the presenters at our gathering said, from the Kabbalistic cosmology, the world is not broken, but hidden, to invite in the hidden aspect. And it talks about, the Shekhinah, divine immanence, blossoms into the feminine half of God, balancing the, what I would say, the hyper-yang death frenzy of the Mars, and the secret of fulfilling the mitzvah, which you can explain, is the mending of all the worlds and drawing forth the emanation from above. According to the Kabbalah, every human action here on earth affects the divine realm, either promoting or hindering the union of Shekhinah and her partner.
What's wonderful about Semitic languages is that they all have a trilateral root that when conjugated in different ways, it brings on new meanings, and sometimes it feels random, but sometimes it feels as if we're getting a message by the different kinds of words that come through. And Shekhinah could be maybe the feminine divine, but if you take that root, which is Shin, Kaf, and Nun in Hebrew, it is also the root of the temple, the holy temple, the Mishkan. It's also the term that's used from living or a place to be, a shuna, would be a neighborhood. So, well, historically, there's probably reasons why these words evolved. When you look at them today, you suddenly find the connection between the divine, the Shekhinah, and the Mishkan, the temple, and the shuna, which is the neighborhood, and Shechen, which is the neighbor, which are these three key letters that, when used with different vowels, different conjugations, suddenly bring on new meanings and new ways of looking at it. And when you think at a place like the Middle East, where languages are related, Arabic and Aramaic and Hebrew, I think all of them coexisted at different times, and those roots go across languages. There's many words that are parallel in Hebrew and Aramaic and Arabic, and those roots evolve in own languages. The root for bread in Hebrew means, I think, meat in Arabic, or the week for summer in Aramaic means vacation in Hebrew, and these parallels kind of create a new way of looking at things. And the word Shekhinah means living, means being in company, being in neighborhood. And I think there's a message there that's coming back from way back from whenever the Proto-Semitic languages was spoken in the Middle East, that within our neighborhood, with the feminine divinity, we might be able to create our own temple.
Yes. And again, this is a democratic show, Oren, so I can proffer things and you can go, no, or I'd rather go over here. I know in a backstage way, we had been bringing up in our conversation the against all odds desirable idea of a one state solution, and then I would say, or a no state solution. Is that something you are willing to kind of animate as a vision?
I think a no-state solution might be a good solution for not only the Middle East.
I mean,
depends how we're seeing how that evolves. Sovereignty sometimes feels like a manifestation of the masculine, but if there's a different way to look at it, whatever a no-state solution could be. A lot of the conflicts that we see around the world, and the one-state solution, the two-state solution, these are all solutions that are coming from around, but never from within. And I like the idea of a no-state solution. I don't know how it would look like or how it would manifest, but
Well, that's,
I'm willing to live in that mystery.
Oh, you're using perfect language. You're using perfect language because, fortunately, according to the astro-mytho guiding backstage of now, we don't have to, nor could we, as befoibled humans, have any concept of how. And the backstage gods would go, don't worry about how. You come up with the desirable vision. We, Jupiter, Uranus, parts of the divine, will do the booking. So we go, well, that's a relief. So because part of the dynamic is, you know, that situations are so complex right now as to completely be beyond human ken in the how realm. I am drawn over and over again to bring up Qahtani in Syria, where the Kurdish women fighters and men, but notable Kurdish women fighters are inspired by the American anarchist writer Murray Bookchin, who is a fabulous wise genius, and we go, really? And they are, you know, strong and hip to not wanting American empire, but they do want American bombs, because every time the bombs stop, Daesh, which is known as ISIS by Western construct, gets closer. And so we go, okay, everybody. So what I want to kind of toss to you is to say, it is beyond. We don't want bombing. We don't want weapons. But we do understand complexity. So to invite in the mythic, the Shekinah, the ISIS, the figure of the wrathful Dakini hovering over Qahtani itself, because one of the strategies, apparently a kind of true superstition, that the women in the Kurdish women in Qahtani say, the Daesh men, ISIS, they fear the women because they feel that to be killed by a woman is to not go to heaven. We go, well, that's true. That's true. And to kill a woman means you don't go to heaven either. And to kill anything, actually. So I like the women broadcasting, going, run, run. And then we just animate, go away and study botany. There you go. Other options. So I think it then we fall back on our strong suit, which is to kind of animate, doesn't have to be realistic. In fact, it can't be, to animate the presiding image of shape-shifting Shekinah, wrathful Dakini, ISIS, or the predominant deity in the Middle East before Orthodoxy was She-Wolf, and there's your wolfy self. So, hovering over the city itself, and then we leave it to the divine as to how it wants to be animated, going, bombs, no bombs, we prefer no bombs, but, whatever greater wisdom thinks. That could be serious, dedicated fun, perhaps, is the idea of conjuring mythic templates to invite power to animate it, since we are beyond the capacity to solve these things in orthodox ways?
Well, I mean, the orthodox ways have been tried for many years, so I think energizing the mystery or the myth or the dialogue or, being with each other in Shekinah and that living together sense, it's worth a shot. I'm learning to live with mystery as I as I move around Northern California and get closer to the edge, and being there at the edge of Point Reyes and Bolinas, I'm learning to accept mystery. I'm learning to accept things that are showing up, and I could see that. And as we welcome the Shekinah, the divine, the Shekinah Hebrew word, which makes me, there's many languages spoken in the Middle East and many cultures, and I'm sure there's other variations of the word spoken throughout that part of the world. Welcoming the mystery that it will bring, and yes, I mean, hopefully it won't manifest those bumps. It seems though it has been always. I don't know.
Well, I want to go back to the first thing that Andy Weil and I ever learned from the Kabbalah in 1970, and it's informed all of our works in varying ways. But I just remember reading in a Kabbalistic commentary that elders, got together and said, if the divine is everything, how does the divine create using nothing outside itself? And they said, well, how do we as humans, using nothing outside ourselves, create? And they said, ah, in our imaginations. So they said, well, imagination, we are dreamed. So when it says we are made in the image of God, it does not mean we are looking like grumpy white guys with beards. It means we are dreamed up by the divine, and our capacity to imagine and dream is the divine part of us. And right now in the Astro Mythos story, Neptune dreams and vision is rising due east in Berkeley and Point Reyes and Northern California, and for the first time in 165 years, Neptune, representing dreams and vision, is in its home realm of Pisces, meaning all esoteric teachings, the beauty of Sufism in Islam, or the Kabbalah in Judaism, or esoteric Christianity, or because all the myths, you know, it's intriguing that in the Grail legend, Percival can only attain the Grail, restore, heal the land, and restore the waters of life when he finds he has a secret twin brother who is half black and Islamic. And we go, well, there we have it, right? In the Christian myth is the crossing of borders. We need everybody in some way to heal the world. But so Neptune says, oh, you humans, you know, come up with desirable imagery, and invite it to be, proffer it as a template to the divine, going, you like this? And if not, we'll come up with something else. When we were speaking backstage, I said, well, you know, against all odds, you know, we want to see, you know, well, there's the Congress and the Senate, and they're getting ready for war, and war on Earth, and XL pipelines, and we want to see, you know, without expectation, we want to see, you know, the trickster part of Obama, you know, vetoing many bad things. And that's why I like saying, well, then let's imagine all those who are, you know, against life, you know, and for the pipeline and whatnot, as Rumpelstiltskin. Rumpelstiltskin, we may remember from our fairy tales, all fairy tales being proffered to us as guiding templates. You know, when the heroine does figure out his secret name and does, he gets so frustrated, so angry that he stomps his foot and has a tantrum yoga fit and breaks the floorboards and is plunged into the underworld, ha ha ha, to be redeemed in some later, you know, Buddhist cosmology maybe. But you were saying that in Hebrew, Rumpelstiltskin is whom again?
Well, I think sometime in the 20s or 30s, the name was translated into Utli Gutzli. And Utzli, Utz is from the root of give me advice, and Gutzli, I think, is joke with me or something like.
So Utzli Gutzli means what?
Rumpelstiltskin means, Utz means give me advice or tell me something. Li means to me, and Gutzli, I think, makes make a joke to me.
Oh, well, we like that. Yes,
yes.
Give me advice and make a joke to me. Utzli-gutzli. I think we could spiral this into our expanding vernacular. Utzli-gutzli. Whenever anything, you know, in strange esoteric schools that I've been a part of, I would dive into until the tyranny would come down, and then I would skedaddle and go, oh, gotta go. But gathering gold and, you know, separating it from the dross and putting it in our magic backpack and continuing the journey, but in some, you know, insane renegade Gurdjieff magic school in London a million years ago. But we were, one of the fun things, we would take a word, again, the power of unexpected, and we would imbue it with whatever, like we were living in a rough neighborhood, protection. So somebody would come up to you on the street, you know, and you'd go, Utzli Gutzli, and they go, whoa, too strange for me, gotta go. Or, you know, my word at the time was rutabaga, which was really good. People go, give me your wallet, lady, and you just go, rutabaga. And they go, whoa. But I think Utzli Gutzli is good that way. Okay, I'm putting it in my magic backpack. Yes, don't rob me, give me advice and make a joke to me. So always teaching, that idea of how do we become surprising in a way that disrupts the tyrannical narrative, you know, and opens up the dance. And I think drawing from all cosmologies is the backstage gods are woofing to us going, there's so much here. You know, in Tibetan exorcism, the demons are on the other side of a locked door, and they're like, and the practice is to imagine a laser coming out of one's third eye and lasering the lock off the door, and then going, come on out, you demons. Nobody's as ugly as Yamantaka, Lord of Death. And then they all dance together. And because we have a Mars-Pluto conjunction right now, you know, and Orthodox astrologers or just generally grumpy people go, oh, war and terrible. And we go, no, it's a lesson. It says that is, which is volatile and dangerous, is volatile and dangerous to the force of its exclusion. The other side of the wall, the other side of the door, the other side of our mind, you know. So, see, the Neptune part, trickster part of all of us would cross borders and then have a little broom to dissolve them once we'd cross them, you know, about left and right and Republican or whatever. And even when we get to the Middle East going, what about intrinsic? Now, it is against all odds, but intrinsic, you know, what connects people, you know, love of land, intrinsic kind of natural places to go back to before 1919, to go back even further, you know, complex history, all those kind, you know, many, many things. But, you know, the image of Jerusalem as an international peace capital, is that something you'd vote for?
Well, it's not for me to vote. It's for the people in Jerusalem to vote for.
Yes, yes.
Well, know, it's like the idea of the other side is so, you know, in Kabbalah, the word for the dark side is the Sitra Acha, which literally means the other side. Oh. You know, it's like to get to the light, you have to go to the other side. Some people would say that's what evilness is, or that's what badness, but it's Sitra Acha means the other side. So, I mean, Jerusalem always had two sides to it. If Jerusalem wanted to be a city of peace, it would be the perfect place for it to be. I mean, the root of Yerushalayim comes from the root Shalem, and Shalem means whole.
Oh.
Whole as in not holy city, but W-H-O-L-E. That's one of the meanings of the word. So if Yerushalayim is a city of wholeness, it should be also the city of peace, because that same root is also the root for Shalom and Salam, which is the word for peace. So I think it's built into the name of the place that it should be such.
Ah, right. Well, no, it's not for you to vote, but we can both vote for others to be voting. So we put on our trestle board the pattern on the trestle board, which I think also has some Kabbalistic connection, you know, possibly in the, you know, hybridization of everything. But it begins by saying, well, it is connected to the tree of life. Zero is all the power that ever was or will be is here now. We go, okay, let's remember that. You know, and then I am, meaning we are, you know, center of expression for the primal will to good, which originally, which eternally creates and sustains the universe, and it goes on. But a complex one, six, Tipareth, is in all things great and small, we see the beauty of the divine expression. That's a worthy and tough assignment, because we do look around and go, not beautiful, but maybe we go back to, you know, the world is not broken, but hidden. There's a hidden wholeness to be invited, into the hearts of all people, going, what was I thinking? You know, my brother and sister Palestinians, and my brother and sister, what was I thinking? I can't even remember. I mean, we might want a kind of spiritual amnesia, to toss into the cauldron reactive retribution. Might be good, do you think?
Mm-hmm. And maybe replaced with reciprocal and regenerative resiliency.
Yes, reciprocal and regenerative resiliency. And then, you know, when we come back from our very short break, we can do blessing and beauty poker, going, alrighty. And the way that against all odds, you know, let's see, Zatar Atai, I apologize if I got his name wrong, but peace activist in in Tel Aviv, had been explaining to me, going, right, at first, you know, where one might have to give up a theocracy and replace it with a democracy. And people go, no, it's terrible, it's terrible. But he, in a very calm way, had a way of saying, but intertwined, you know, again, like a Fibonacci spiral, one's giving these things up, but one is getting security and prosperity. How about that? And it might take, it might take a divine second, which we don't know what that is in human time, but that's something I want to just sort of put on our work table, and we're going to take a very short break, but you can hang with us, right, Oren?
I can hang.
Excellent. Our guest is Oren Slosberg. He is the chief strategist. Let's talk about strategy and beauty when we get back. And arts innovation program director at Commonweal. That's commonweal.org. Beautiful organization. And what we're about to hear now is, you know, we sent a little piece of machinery, we humans, to the comet yesterday. It landed, whatever it was, 16 million gazillion beyond our ken light years away. It landed. And in doing so, it also recorded the song of the comet, and here's that. That was the comet singing to us. This is Caroline Casey on the Visionary Activist Show, KPFA 94.1. And that was the song, amplified 10,000 times because it is beyond human ken and hearing. But that is the song of the comet that our little piece of machinery, human machinery, landed on yesterday. And we go, ah, what a creation is singing to us. And we don't know if people thought of that as a civil defense signal or whatever, but it was amplified 10,000 times because apparently it's quite subtle, but there it is. I like that comets were always thought to herald the downfall of tyrants. And we go, sure, thank you. Thank you, comet. Wasn't that a fun song, Oren Slosberg, our guest today?
It sounds like a whale on speed.
It is a whale on speed. There we go. Well, yeah, I mean, everything's singing to us. So we had put some impossible things on our work table because, you know, why not? Because our task as befoibled humans, truly we all are, is to go, things are so complex, we have reached mere human limits in our capacity to resolve conflict with any ideology or orthodoxy. And we are all being invited really to go back to our own, each one of us, unique original instructions, and to go back to the originating impulse behind all wise teachings, go all the way back to, you know, and kind of touch that and give it, you know, and offer ourselves as going, what is wise and dancing and spiraling and unifying and dedicated to peace and brings out the best in everybody. Oren Slosberg is chief strategist. I think that's a great chief strategist of the shadow world government. No, chief strategist and arts innovation program director at Commonweal, which is a beautiful dedicated place. But let's talk about strategy. What? How do you define being a chief strategist on a kind of maybe literal or mythological level? And, you know, if you run out of words, I'll jump in. And Wolfie, too. I want to go back to wolves. But chief strategist, it's a great title.
I love it. I got it from a friend who worked at a foundation in New York as they were doing strategic planning, which is a buzzword in the nonprofit world, as a way to try and figure out where you're going, which is kind of bizarre because it's really hard to know where you're going. But the whole concept of strategic planning inherently has some challenges built in it. But when Michael Lerner, who's the founder of Commonweal, who is the person that brought me to Commonweal, he tasked me with Commonweal has been around for 40 years and has done amazing work in the world in many different areas, in environment and health and juvenile justice and working with people with cancer, and as well as in the arts and education. And looking ahead at the next years, what are we going to do? And my first instinct as someone that's been in nonprofit work for many years is that I'll do a strategic plan. But strategic plan just didn't work. So we're trying to figure out how do we look ahead? What is it that, how do you accept things that just show up? How do you accept the fact that we can't predict the future? We don't know where we're going to be 5 years from now. So what do we do now to prepare as we look ahead? And it feels that sometimes a chief strategy officer's role is really just to be patient and just to look and accept the fact that we actually can't plan in that way. We can look ahead, we can hope, we can dream, we can put things in place, but how things are going to move, I'm starting to believe more and more in randomness and chaos and openness and just waiting for things to show up.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, the word predict, same root as predicament, almost always a bad thing. But I like saying better to create prophecy than live prediction, but without any inflated stuff, without any inflated prophecy stuff. But I think to offer a, you know, templates, of the desirable, and chief strategist sounds, you know, it's like a positive Mars thing. And since I do think of you and refer to you as one of the most erudite and lupine chief strategists and arts innovation program directors, Wolfie, and you'd said that people sometimes called you Wolf, yeah?
Well, it's actually my middle name.
It is?
My middle name is Zev, is Wolf, yes.
Ah, so you are. So they got the name right.
Yeah, my parents got that part. And my first name is Orn, which means pine tree, which in Hebrew does not mean much. So in Japanese, the pine tree is the one that conveys the word of God to earth. But in Hebrew, it's just a pine tree. But my middle name is indeed Wolf.
And what about Slazburg, the city of Slaz? What is Slaz?
Well, it's probably from the German Schloss, which means the name in Hebrew or in German would be Schlossberg, which would be castle.
Uh-huh. City castle.
I guess if I was to have a shield, it would be a wolf under a pine tree on a mountain in a castle.
Right, and it's the wolf's castle. As people have been hanging with me for a while, no, I often repeat this, but if you're just tuning in and going, what the hell is this? Let me just put, you know, let all natural facts be social strategy metaphors. Let us derive our metaphors from nature and heal this thing. But my favorite model of leadership, and that's what we're really supposed to be thinking about now with Venus in the underworld in Mesoamerica, that would be understood as a time when all leadership has proved itself corrupt, and Venus Quetzalcoatl has gone off to go brood, going, boy, I was a terrible leader, and then to, you know, redefine what we want in leadership in each one of us, as well as the outer thing. But my favorite one is Wolf, having lived with Captain Moondog Wolfie, an actual hybrid wolf, great being ancestor now. But it was Michael Fox of the Humane Society, destiny in a name, I guess, but who had said, you know, wolves don't operate on dominance, they operate on charisma. And in wolf culture, charisma means who initiates play best. woof, woof, want to play. And not just play, you know, let's go raise money, let's go hunting, let's do this, you know, but it is the wolf who engages the playful ingenuity of the pack. And I go, yes, that. And you can tell the alpha, the future alpha wolf within 10 days of birth because it's the wolf pup with the lowest resting heartbeat. And I think that's a great, for me, that's a great model, being completely anti-authoritarian and everything. It's a great model for leadership going, right, the coolest and the person who engages the playful ingenuity of the pack, wolf. Wolf, there it is. So you have it in your middle name. We go, that's good. And that model also, it was Gunelli Gun, wonderful Turkish author years ago on this show, who at the very, very end, I didn't have a chance to go, wait, come back here. At the end of the show, she said, you know, throughout the Middle East, in pre-Orthodox, you know, religion, pre-Ottoman and everything, the predominant deity was She-Wolf. I was like, really? And she said the predominant deity there, throughout the Middle East, there was, you know, azure blue flags emblazoned with an alpha wolf's head on it that blew throughout the Middle East. I'm like, where do I find this? Let's bring her back. And when I was in Syria, I asked people about this, going, do you know about She-Wolf? And they go, yeah, it's a children's story. It used to be told. I can't quite remember. I go, yeah, bring back. Well, I mean, and She-Wolf, Shekhinah, Scheherazade, I'm putting them all together just for the, you know, irresponsible fun of it all, going, Shekhinah, She-Wolf, Scheherazade, the power of stories to, you know, to save all women, lift the curse from the land, and heal even the heart of the tyrant who has hardened his heart. So maybe Shekhinah, She-Wolf. But you too have not heard of She-Wolf, I gather from your inhalation.
No, I haven't. So it's funny. I mean, my brain works in numbers, and the word in Hebrew for a she-wolf would be a ze'eva, which would add up to 15, which is also the numerology of the word Yah, which is God.
Ah, okay.
So, that pops in. There has to be something then.
Well, we want to, you know, the divine is not an old white guy with a beard, for goodness sake, you know. You know, that was from the, you know, the entrained, corrupted infancy of our human mythology, which it behooves us to outgrow now and to go and to, you know, address in wonderment the divine going, how would you like to be addressed? And then I like myself, being reverently irreverent and all that, you know, to say right now, you know, we throw everything into the cauldron, all sacred teachings, everything, and go, are you equal? Are you equal Mars and Venus, strategy and beauty? Are you equal male, female? Are you equal humans and the rest of creation on this planet? Is the trickster, playful, disruptive element welcome? Can the truth be said, you know, in a playful, spiraling, dancing kind of way? Yes, we ladle you out. No, we throw you back in for another round of bubbling. Is that an acceptable image for yourself?
I can. There are many things that I have seen over the years that I would put in that cauldron to let them bubble and simmer and see what comes out of them.
Well, I think so, because we leave it to the divine going, you know, and it's useful too when people get grumpy, as I told you when I was, you know, just wondering about the Abrahamic story, because I'm allowed to, in a talk. And I know I have many, many great rabbi friends, but a particularly grumpy rabbi came up to me and said, I've never been so insulted in all my life. And I go, the evening is young, sir. But then somebody else came up and said, bah, rah, 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 rah. And I go, okay, all right, let's join hands and jump into this cauldron together in our mind's eye. And if there's any part of us that is not dedicated to the greater good of all beings, let it be bubbled away. And the person was surprised and said, you mean that? And I was like, sure. And she was like, cool, let's do that. So we did. We held hands and we imagined jumping into this cauldron together. And she was like, that was fun. So again, the power of metaphor, let us all, you know, spiraling into the memosphere, let us all realize that, you know, we want to expand our repertoire of responses and imaginative profound whimsy, you know, in ways to dance rather than, you know, and, you know, grumpitude, righteousness, you know, composting into that, you know, I do not want to presume to impose what the comet might have been singing to us, but I do like that comets were about, you know, the composting or downfall of tyranny into actual democracy as fought. So you did grow up. You said you spent your first 25 years. Well, you were born in Hollywood, Oren. Which is very witty because that's the place where images of profound beauty have been kidnapped and, you know, forced into servitude to Disney and celebrity and whatnot. So you land at the place where powerful images have been, you know, held hostage. And then you go, I got it. Now I'm moving to Israel. I mean, when you were born in Hollywood, and then what?
At the age of 6, my parents, after going to school here, moved back to Israel, and I was there until I was 25 and wanted to move back to the United States.
So you are a cross-pollinating agent from literal and dream symbolic Hollywood, Israel, Commonweal, Bolinas, and other places in Northern California. What are the medicines, we might ponder, of those places that you would like to brew together? The antidote's always right next to the poison. So 6 years in Hollywood, then that was enough for you. That's very witty. Okay, 6 years of Hollywood, you take that to Israel, 25 years in Israel. This is a big thing. You know, what would be the medicine of beauty in Israel that would be available to all of us to invite and honor, do you suppose?
There's something about growing up in the country, in that specific land, that has many names. That I remember wandering and seeing the antiquities that have piled up there, and the metaphor of the tell, which I'm not sure how you say it in English, but it's just a mound which has layers of different civilizations over the last thousands of years, and it becomes visual. You see these mounds all over the country, and you can see things from biblical times and Neolithic times and Ottoman times and the Islamic Caliphate times and the Ottoman times, and they're all layered on top of each other, and they literally create a small hill in the middle of what was probably a flat area before. And that is an image that's very powerful for me, because they bleed into each other. You can't tell where one ends and when one starts. Each generation might have used stones from the previous, and the metal from one became, you know, the metals of one's plows became the weapons of another's, which became the currency of the third. And I think if that was an image I could take and create and share, that would be looking at things differently, having that actual physical representation of how all these cultures have lived on top of each other for so many thousands of years. One of the places that always reminds me of the cradle of civilization is our caves in the Carmel Mountains, where there has been continuous populations for hundreds of thousands of years, including an overlap between Neanderthals and the beginning of the Homo sapiens. And it's one of the few places that we know of in the world where there's been continuing presence of humans in the same place. And it's not a coincidence that it's in that part of the world where you have these tells as well. So there's an image. Ancient cities piled on top of each other.
That is a good one. And it reminds me of at least 200 or 300 things. A wonderful ally, spirit brother, David Grimes, friend of show, when he was in Israel, he was like, oh, it's difficult. But he did find, he apparently leapt over barbed wire, to go to the source of the Jordan River, which is in a cave sacred to Pan. And once he found that, he was like, oh, we know that the Middle East is a major bird migratory route. And we go, oh, come on, humans, you know, you owe it to the birds to settle down and make it beautiful and plant beautiful things with no pesticide and all this. The other thing is, when I was in Palmyra, Syria, when it was all still beautiful, and may it be again, but our guide took us to the Temple of Baal, and he said, here's how the creators of this temple kept it safe, because this is a place where all expressions of the divine are welcome. So he said, he pointed it out, and he goes, here's a Islamic thing, and here's a Judaic thing, and here's a, you know, a maybe she-wolf thing, and here's a Hindu thing, and whatever. So nobody would go, I'm going to destroy, oh, I can't. You know, and he said the physical corollary was that the temple itself was held together with brass things, cylinders, that's the word, surrounded by lead. So when there was an earthquake, the lead would liquefy and the whole building would dance or would move in a coherent way. And I go, that's brilliant. And he goes, so there was the metaphysical or religious form of keeping it safe as a corollary to the brass and the lead moving as well, that people still come from Japan to study, or they did before there was, you know, war, and then maybe so again. But no, I love that. So the deep archaeological layers, and we would invite them going right in our mythic minds, in our, you know, and actually when you say Neanderthals and Homo sapiens, well, you say that they might have lived together, right, rather than one beating the other up with a, you know, a large bone. Do we know that Neanderthals and Homo sapiens at one point, you know, were like, hi, how are you?
Well, that is one of the speculations of this specific site, because some of the evidence that they found are timed from more or less the same period. So there is the possibility that they coexisted at the same time, at least at this specific site. Whether they talked to each other, whether they intermixed or intermingled, I don't know. But that is one of the legends that goes along with this, with the Carmel Caves, is that they found things that, through, I guess, carbon dating, I'm not sure exactly how it works, but that they were at the same time, that the two different species of humanoids existed at the same time.
Yes, and that, again, is pre any orthodox religion, right? I mean, we're going way back to just, you know, mystery. Yeah, so I think, you know, part of us, you know, our nearest exit may be behind us, going, let's go way back to, again, original intimacy, and this idea of chief strategist, yes, as a good wolf Mars leader, you know, engaging the playful ingenuity of the pack, may it be a wolfy cloak around your shoulders, and arts innovate. Well, actually, it's kind of, your title is kind of perfect, actually. Chief strategist, which is kind of positive Mars, and arts innovation, which is, there's the Venus part.
Mm-hmm.
And program director, we get Saturn. Anyway, the whole gang's here. So, chief strategist and art. So there's a Mars Venus kind of dance, and we go, right. And then, you know, what I've been kind of encouraging in all of us, and we do want to spiral this out into the memosphere, let's, you know, our desire for retribution and punishment be thrown into the cauldron and label out, you know, Rumpelstiltskin or imaginative sentencing, you know, or, you know, justice or a unifying story that, you know, is beyond our capacity to come up with it. But in speaking with you know, friends in Syria, and reminding us that part of the beauty of the Middle East that comes from the land before people put names on it, is that it is a land of blessing. I mean, the Bedouin blessing is, you know, or greeting is halu, you know, change your direction and come this way. And, you know, part of the beauty of the Abrahamic complex thing, is, you know, the welcoming of the stranger. Welcome, stranger, how wonderful. And I do remember just knocking on a door with my friend Deborah in the middle of this, you know, cold, you know, a kind of Bedouin town. I guess they'd been forced into the town, you know. And the woman opening the door warily and then going, yes, and then going, strangers, how wonderful. And it was like, you know, what a boy, we could use some of that. So what Deborah and I, you know, is blessing poker, because it was, you know, make a well for you. What color are you today? And the answer would always be, Alhamdulillah, all praise the divine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and may it go well for you, and may orange blossoms, you know, waft across your path, and I see your blessing and raise you one. And I wanted to kind of toss to you, or toss to all of us, you know, the idea of blessing poker. You know, I see your blessing, raise you one. But beauty poker, you know, here's a beautiful song from our people, our Palestinian people. Ooh, that is beautiful. Here's a, here's another beautiful song from our people. Ooh, that's very much like the song that we knew when we, here's a, so if we were going to do beauty poker, I see beauty and raise you one in a kind of infinite game to keep everybody playing rather than a finite game, which is about winning. So, priming the pump of, you know, beauty. So you've really done part of this already, but the beauty of the Middle East, do things rise up that you find beautiful? Here's a beautiful thing. Here's a beautiful story. Here's a beautiful word. Here's a beautiful, any beauty poker? Is your hand full of beauty?
Well. As the idea of the beauty poker of here's a song, I'll rise you one, here's an image, I'll rise you one, the first word that came to mind is inshallah, which means, you know, may God make it so, I think. I mean, it's before I was at Commonweal, I was working for many years in the area of visual art and how we engage with that and how does it make us think and how do we make meaning out of the world around us. And thinking of images for the Middle East, the first images that come up to mind are the Arabic script, which always seems to flow. It always looks like oceans. It always looks like flowers and the word in wind. The word Allah is spelled with an aleph, and it's basically three towering letters. And in many eras, you see these across the top of buildings or in mosques. And while there's no direct imagery of nature life, the letters themselves actually come to life. And so much of the Arabic calligraphy to me has this sense of flow, this sense of ocean, this sense of trees kind of blowing in the wind. I think of like Van Gogh's wheat fields in a sense where you can actually feel the movement. You can see that in some of those images. And they're across the Middle East and they all, you know, the Hebrew letters, the Arabic letters, the Aramaic letters, and I guess the Greek and Roman ones all actually come out of the same place. They all come out of the Phoenician alphabet. So maybe some of that is some of the beauty that started there and is still preserved in so much of this art form there.
No, that is wonderful. And the idea, you know, it's true, the Arabic script is so curvy, so feminine, so snaky. If anything's anywhere, it's everywhere. And, you know, part of the mystery is, you know, there I was, you know, just a little person, kind of Irish sort of person, growing up in D.C., but as a little child, I loved the call to prayer. You know, Allah, Akbar. I was like, because it was so full of curvy yearning and ascendance, and I go, whoa! So maybe for all of us to rescue what has been kidnapped and forced into unimaginative service to tyranny, alphabets, words, run from the mouths of liars. Go free, you alphabets and words, you know, and yes, power of the blessing, to liberate that. And, you know, again, a common unity. Yeah, because it's true that as you say, you know, calligraphy and Hebrew and Arabic and Aramaic scripts, all cultures understood alphabets and language as living and magic and invocative. And I like to ponder, you know, that, you know, the tyrant, the colonizer really needs the medicine of what he colonizes, just as a, like, ponder that, that America really needs the underneath, you know, beauty and blessing of the Middle East underneath all the Moors, you know, and to go for the Venus. You know, England really needed the metaphysic of India. What do you think, Israel? We've got 20 seconds here, Oren. This is part one. What do you think Israel needs as a beautiful medicine from the Palestinian people?
I don't even know where to.
No, that's true. That's right. Let us all ponder that. And what medicine from Israel might the Palestinian people need? Underneath everything, it's a koan. It's a koan for all of us to wonder.
I would say that the medicine should come from the bottom of the tell, from the bottom of that mound that has those years of history. I think that might be part of the medicine, is to look back and look at those, you know, you can look back as far as where our shared roots are in terms of evolution, but you can sort of learn back in so many ways, and maybe that's the foundation of that tell is where, you know, the natural land, which was first built on, there might be the medicine.
That is a very good direction. We will honor your guidance, oh great ally in perpetuity. Oren Slazberg, he is the Chief Strategist and Arts Innovation Program Director at Commonweal. Thank you so much, Oren. Let us continue to spiral our dance, and to all dynamic listeners as well. Thanks always to our team, Douglas Bell in Washington, D.C., and Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. I'm Caroline Casey. We will reconvene next week. Woof, woof, woof. Thank you, Oren.
The KPFA Crafts Fair is our largest annual off-air event and takes place at the Craneway in Richmond on December 20th and 21st. You are invited to join the KPFA Crafts Fair team. Friendly, reliable volunteers are needed to help staff the doors and assist exhibitors at the fair. Your help is invaluable to the success of our event. And this is a great opportunity to come to the fair as KPFA's guest in return for working a 3-hour shift. We need your help Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. To sign up, contact Felix at 510-848-6767, extension 629, or email volunteer@kpfa.org. To see the volunteer shift hours for each day,